So I think the ladies are much more capable of speaking on this subject than we are. Now, I know there are several of you in this group that we've been together many times, and I haven't particularly changed what I've been saying about this for a long time. So if you decide you want to redeem the time and take a nap, well, you just go right ahead while we're talking about this, okay? One of the most interesting books in the Bible, I think, is the Song of Solomon, because it deals with the most intimate of human relationships. And someone has suggested if this Song of Solomon were not in the Bible, we might have reason to question its inspiration, because certainly God is going to speak upon that which is the most important and most intimate relationship that a man and woman has. Now, as background in this Song of Solomon, it's I think difficult to understand the way that it's laid out. So sometimes, when you want to do a good Bible study, I suggest that you take this Song of Solomon and rewrite it in the manner in which it plays. Would be that. That is, you have Act 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then you have Scene 1, 2, and 3, and 4 in each act, and then you identify the speakers. The Dixon Bible outline on this book suggests that the historical background is that King Solomon had a summer castle up in Syria, where he went to escape the heat of the summer from Jerusalem. And that one summer while he was up there, he somehow made contact with the local Miss Universe. Now, I don't know whether he was called on to stand here in the ceremony or that, but he made contact with her and decided that he wanted to add her to his head. So he sent word out and took her. And it happened that she was already committed to somebody else. And that apparently this summons to the pastor was so quick that she didn't have time to explain him while she was going up there. So he was greatly concerned about her visit. And so the opening conversation, one of them, is what she said to him, reassuring him that she had no interest whatsoever in anybody except him. But Solomon was not to be deterred, and so he had her forcefully taken to escape. And then he let her stay home, but when it came time to return down to Jerusalem, he had her captured again and took her down to Jerusalem. And the story was filled with conversations that those women had with her. They were, who is this horrible incident? What are her more? And then she would about her beloved. Apparently, this young man followed her around the city, and they had a number of conversations throughout this experience that are recorded. But finally, over toward the end of the book, Solomon made this wild conclusion. He said, "Many waters cannot quench life, neither can the flood giant. If a man would give all the substance of his house for life, it would utterly be condemned." He had utilized every resource in his empire to win the favor of that young lady. He could not. So he gave up on the side of that. Well, this is an interesting background to this, and I forget sometimes that you do that. And then you do a somewhat copy. I know that one. So. But his conclusion, many levels cannot count less. However, there is smaller things than the right. But sometimes a place of strain on its relationship. I'm personally pastoring people that sanctuary in love or want to be or something. And I've kind of figured out a little deal to try to find out what's further up. And around the navigators, we heard of word hand and the Bible hand. Well, let's return and get into the real hand. So, as I have observed my own experience and experience with some others, I feel that one of the first things that happens between a man and a woman, a boy and a girl, is a rub. Now, there can be 30 people in the room, and you don't know who they are, but somebody else comes in, and you don't know who they are. And that person leaves the room, will become a rub. So they become aware of one another. Now, the second thing here, as I get better acquainted, is what I would call respect. You do not further repent at somebody that you don't respect. And then the third thing is admiration. And you begin to see in this person just a little bit more as I ask you. And when you engage a person in conversation about the one they're in a good man, well, just rehearse all kinds of merit and admirable qualities that you can see that they're there, but they're nothing to flip out of your head about, you know. Admiration. And then I think affection begins to come in here from Luke and half of rapidly. And when affection comes in, well, we get just a little bit illogical when our thoughts and second hope of gratification. And then finally, this all terminates in what we call love. And this is a state of complete irrationality. One of the events in the lifetime of some of us that rocked the world was when a king of England that had the throne last few years abdicated the throne because they wouldn't let him marry a divorce. And he gave his explanation as to how he abdicated the throne and has rocked the world with scandal of it. He says that I cannot cope. I am a responsibility. I just thought. Just now, the supporting country of the woman I love. So he told him this. You know when this happened? Some of them? And I tell you, love sometimes requires some irrational things. Now, Rossi, I found a trying to find out where a person is, and that's where the council begins. But my purpose in mentioning this is that the foundation of a lasting relationship after the newness, if we can say that, either emotionally and the physical, isn't what it used to be. The lasting foundation is mutual respect. This is a lifetime thing. I have a plan to make sure that we maintain each other's respect. And there are no ground rules for this, because everybody thinks that we've just got the same right. What we do to maintain the respect of our partners and what we cannot do. Otherwise, the relationship deteriorates. For many waters cannot censure that little things that undermine mutual respect. Now, this isn't ever going to move around. I mean, become something more popular than that. But very often, couples who are about to start off life together ask me if I have any advice. I'm sure they'll do the same for you. Well, I said, well, I do have a bit of a dress. So, just one thing. Make this a life rule. Never. Never. And when it's different, criticize Yoga. Ayurveda. One thing. And that includes the setting. This no better land for it, but you will not do it. Because this is one of the quickest ways to end it. We should suffer not to deal with the problem, but it's fixed. But let it go. And then be fixed. Well, this is what's in the back. Now, I'm going to suggest two or three things here. And we'll discuss some of them in detail. What a husband owes for one. Now, I can't think of a better word than this word, owes. Over in the Proverbs 5:25-33, there is some pretty pertinent information as to how much a man is to love his wife. And you remember that this comparison in there, husband, love your wife, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself an apostle. Somebody wondered once if he didn't love his wife too much. So he was asked by the person whom he was speaking, do you love her more than Christ loved you? And he said, well, I don't know. He said, then maybe that's the standard. Love her as much as Christ loved you. Now, I want to discuss the background here. A couple of years ago, I was in the dentist's office at Barber's shop, and I picked up a magazine that had the front three pages and back page was missing. And I saw this little dialogue on the back page. I don't know the name of the magazine or what went before or after, but from the context, it was obvious that this dialogue was going on because of a younger couple was having some notice, and they had gone over to an older couple at the time. And at the time of this dialogue, the wife was talking to the older wife, and the young man was talking to the older one. So the conversation opened when the older man said to the younger man, she wanted to be reassured that you loved her. And the younger man said, but I was too. And the older man said, I don't care what you do. When a woman needs to be reassured that you love her, if you have the IQ of a man, you'll stop what you're doing and take care of that other stuff. Well, the younger, he couldn't see that. So the old other fellow went on to explain. He said, now, a woman is a different creature than a man. By nature, we live in a big world. Things are moving rapidly and not going on. She feels just a little frightened and a little insecure in this big world. The greatest thing that can happen in her life will come someday. A man comes along. And she becomes the most important person in his life. Then she's alone, and she isn't afraid of him. So, they're married. But if she reflects back over, she just can't believe that this good person has become a kind of dream. And she just wondered, it's too good to be true. And then, husband does a little something. And she goes in. I just thought this, didn't I? And she begins to doubt whether or not she is still the most important person in her life. And when she begins to doubt, she needs to be with you right on the spot. Now, what the older fellow went on to say to the younger, he said, every moment that you deprive her of that knowledge and assurance and security, you are feeling that part of your life. You have no right to feel. So just take care of it. And I believe that this was prime advice that was given in this story. So I say that we owe to our wives, first of all, the security of always knowing that she is still and always the most important person in our life. Now, fellows, if you can please hear, we had a couple conference several years ago that came here on the honeymoon. Now, I think they made about 2 days. Okay. So I was talking with them, and they one month, I give them a sample. I don't know why they asked me, but I had to talk to them. I thought I'd test my spirit. So I said to him, this was about 5 days after marriage, I said to him, I told him both of them, I said, has she asked you yet if you still love her? And they both really looked shocked, you know, as though I'd been listening when they thought they were in private. So they start pretty early. And it's a lifetime assignment. Now, the next thing that we want to talk about, I think the most important thing we'll discuss here this morning, and I really hope we'll discuss it. For the background of this, I want to read 1 Corinthians 14, some verses here. Now, you remember in 1 Corinthians 14, Paul had been setting down some instructions about some things that he thought were disorderly and not what they should be in the assembly of the church. So after he got all through giving instruction on this, it's just like he said, now, there's something else I've had on my mind for a long time, and this seems to be a good place to work it out. So he took up a new subject, and here it is in verse 34. Now, don't prejudge what the teaching is here. He says, let your women keep silent in the city, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also says the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a sin for women to speak in the city. I heard an old veteran missionary give an exposition on this one. It sounds like me. In many parts of the world, you know that when you go into a worship service in a church, that there's a partition right down the middle. And if you walk in the back door, the men go on one side, the women on the other, and it's about 6 feet high. So they sit down, the men on one side, the women on the other, and they don't see each other. Now the preacher up in front, he's elevated, and of course he can talk to the whole audience as though they were one. But I don't know why they started this, unless they felt it would be more worshipful to separate the men and women, but many parts of the world, it's real popular if you go into the church. And apparently this is true in the building in which they met in the day that this was written. Now, it's about 10 minutes to 11, and people start in the church. The men have seen one another during the course of the week, in their business and other relationships. And as they come up to the church, they just give a nod, go in, sit down in their side of the church, and bow their heads, open the Bible, begin to meditate very spiritually, though, get their hearts all ready for a real blessing and worship service. But over on the other side of the petition, as the women come in, they haven't seen each other since last Sunday, probably. So they sit down in an attempt to get in the right frame of heart and mind to enjoy the service. But as they begin to look around, they notice that somebody's missing.
So they just can't resist the temptation. Well, where's Mary this morning? Well, didn't you hear? No. Why, her oldest boy broke his leg. No. He did? I hadn't heard about that. What was that? What was that? You know? And pretty soon, well, they begin to catch up on this little item. Then they've got another item to catch up on. So pretty soon, the group gets bigger and it gets noisier and louder. And over on the other side of the partition, the men kind of begin to scowl. And pretty soon, the preacher walks in to start the service. And instead of everybody being in the right spirit for worship, well, here's this noise going on, and the men over here looking over that petition. So he practically has to bang the gavel to get order. And this is not a very good way to start off a service. So Paul said, now I want to add something else about order in the service. Let the women keep silent when they come in. He says, if you want to paraphrase this, if they're not up to date on the news, let them ask their husbands at home. So when they come in here, they haven't got to catch up on the current events. So this passage is not an indictment of the women as much as it is an indictment against the men for not keeping their wives up on the latest scoop. And that's exactly what they said. Let them ask their husband at home. Now, when I talked to my wife about this, she said, but what if their husbands won't tell them? Well, maybe they do ask their husbands at home, but they still don't come through. I think the greatest problem in human relations, I've heard this mentioned, is in this matter of communication. This is the problem to be solved. I brought with me, excuse me, the May 1966 Reader's Digest. And there's an article in here, condensed from McCall's magazine. And the subject is, Why Men Don't Talk to Their Wives. And they conducted three very exhaustive panels to try to get information on this. So the person writing the article says the complaint that the husband doesn't talk, just sits back or is withdrawn, is one of the most common problems we've faced. Now, this is the head of a large family counseling service. And he said, I'd say that at least 50% of trouble marriages we see share the factor of the silent husband. Over 50% problems originate just here in this realm of communication. One woman said, my husband brings two TV sets into the room so he can watch football on one and baseball on the other. Then he gets a college game on the radio and works over his coin collection. And he'll know what's happening on every set. Yet he can sit at the dinner table and not hear a word I say. Now, they take a kind of a positive attitude the first of this article. The question, of course, is, what is she saying at the dinner table? Is it something a human being can stand listening to? In the course of the panel discussion, it came out that it truly was not. This wife was a one-woman grievous committee, and she was always in session. According to the psychoanalyst with whom her case was later discussed, she may have been lucky that her husband was silent. If he had talked, he probably would have told his wife what he thought of her, and that would have been the end of their marriage. But this is the extreme and not the solution. One woman said, before I was married, I used to go out on dates to restaurants. And just by looking around the room, I could tell who was married and who wasn't. Either the married couples were eating in dead silence, or the woman was gabbing away while the man ate and pretended she wasn't there. She said, I swore that this would never happen to me. But it has. Now there's other things that are said in here But I think we'll go on to something else. The summary of this is, a misplaced sense of personal dignity may keep many husbands from admitting how intensely dependent they are on the permanence of their homes and the love of their wives. But in satisfying marriages, most wives are perfectly aware of this need, whether it is put into words or not. Many of the women spoke of their silent husbands with affection. Others were amused at them. Still others obviously were furious and disappointed in their marriages. All three groups agreed, now this is the three panel groups, that husbands talk too little, listen too infrequently, and so forth. So this is a universal problem. Talk too little, listen too little. The American Medical Association put out an article on this, which I think was intended to be more humorous than it was informative. But it's on this topic of man and wife conversation discussed. And says the reason husbands and wives don't talk to each other may be because nature never intended the sexes to converse. Now, he's talking about a theory of origins in here and development of man that I don't believe in, but and probably you don't either, but I'll read it anyway. He said, in the beginning, it was sufficient for the male to bring home the kill, his mate to cook it, with no exchanges between them beyond an occasional oath. This article was in Today's Health, published by AMA. Now he says, deep in the male animal are bred thousands of centuries of regarding women as slaves. And for hundreds of years, even after civilization began, in most societies, men ruled the oral roost. Small wonder, then, that having finally burst their bonds, women are anxious to make up for lost time. Or that, after long conditioning, men regard this comparatively recent manifestation, the articulate woman, with a mixture of amazement and distress. Rather than get into a serious discussion with his wife, a man prefers to let well enough alone. So he listens guardedly, if at all, to his wife's hopeful outpourings. He does not make the mistake of encouraging her by his own comments, which might lead to a genuine discussion. By his demeanor, he registers polite discomfort, if not outright resistance, and at the first graceful moment, he escapes. If women are sensible, they make the best of it. The wife shouldn't blame her husband for something he can't help. She shouldn't expect too much. But she shouldn't stop trying altogether. She can always pick up the phone and call a friend. Now, this is in a lighter vein, but the fact that so much is written on this, I think, is just evidence that this is a real problem. So I would suggest that we heed the admonition of 1 Corinthians 14 and give our wives an opportunity to ask us something at home, and then that we answer them. Dick Halverson, who was I was in charge of the young married couples anyway at the Hollywood Presbyterian Church for years, said that whenever he saw difficulty arising among a couple, this is where he always started, and before he would counsel with them, he made them set aside 1 hour a week just to talk. They had to put that in their schedule. Nothing else to have, just set it aside, get along, just to talk. And this helped in the solution of a great many problems. Just talk it out. So we owe our wives the security of knowing that they're the most important person in our lives, and also this matter of communication. This article in Reader's Digest is a very good article, and it brings out that the most crucial time in a marriage is while there are children in the home. And the wife gets mighty tired of being without adult conversation, day after day after day. But this is what happens when there are young and growing children in the home. As men, we get to talk with adults all day long. Now, if your wives were here, I would mention what your wife owes to you, too. And I'm going to mention this because it sets a pretty high standard. I read this to a group of pastors that I had in a discussion group once from the Amplified, and after I'd read it, one of these preachers reached over and grabbed the Bible out of my hand. And he said, "Is that in there?" Now, verse 33 in the Amplified New Testament, Ephesians 5:33. "However, let each man of you, without exception, love his wife as being, in a sense, his own very self. And let the wife see that she respects and reverences her husband, that she notices him, regards him, honors him, prefers him, venerates and esteems him, and that she defers to him, praises him, and loves and admires him exceedingly." That's what the wife has to do for the husband. So, in order for her to do that, kind of sets a standard for our conduct, doesn't it? Over in 1 Peter chapter 3, I believe it's verse 1, the same subject is again discussed. This is instruction again to wives, verses 1 and 2, 1 Peter 3 in the Amplified. "In like manner, you married women, be submissive to your own husbands. Subordinate yourself as being secondary to and dependent on them, and adapt yourselves to them, so that even if any do not obey the word of God, they may be won over by that discussion, not by discussion, but by the godly lives of their wives. When they observe the pure and modest way in which you conduct yourselves together with your reverence for your husband, that is, you are to feel for him all that reverence includes, to respect, defer to, revere him. Revere means to honor, esteem, appreciate, prize, and in the human sense, adore him. And adore means to admire, praise, be devoted to, deeply love, and enjoy your husband. But this has to be a response to something that we are, if they're to do this, doesn't it? Now, I've got two or three other things down here. We're about to run out of time, so I think I'll go ahead and wind this up. And take time for a little discussion here if you want to. I don't want this to be a one-way session. I'd just like to mention two other things here. I have down that we owe our husband also consideration from 1 Peter 3:7. And leadership from Genesis 18:19. But let me suggest, this is a little outside of the subject here, what we as parents, and particularly husbands and fathers, owe to the children. And for an illustration of this, I would go into Genesis 22. And you remember the story, how that Abraham took Isaac. He told the people he's going up on Mount Moriah to offer a sacrifice. Isaac was someplace between 18 and 30 years old, and Abraham was over 100. There wasn't a whole lot of a physical match between the two. So Isaac said, "Well, we got the wood and everything, but where's the sacrifice?" And so Abraham said, "Well, the Lord's going to provide one. But in the meantime, Isaac, you lay down on this wood. And just to make sure that you get suspicious of my intentions," why he bound his hands and feet there. Now, this was a mature man, Isaac, at that time, at least 18, maybe 30. But Isaac never resisted at all. And I've tried to figure out why he would be so naive in a situation like this. And my conclusion is that in all of his life, in his association, Isaac with Abraham, when it came to the things of God, Abraham had never made any mistake at all. If Abraham said God was going to do this, God always did it. So when Abraham told him that God's going to provide a sacrifice, well, it never crossed his mind but what God was going to provide was. Now I wonder, in front of my wife and my children, how much my testimony really means. When I tell them about something about what God will do, is this based on experience or just some theology I picked up someplace along the line? So that which we owe both to our wives and children is the power of example. One of our great educators said, example is not the best method of teaching. It is the only method of teaching. Now, one final thought. Several years ago, Dr. Edmund of Wheaton College wrote a book about Charles G. Finney. And in here, they considered a question. When does revival come? Throughout history, throughout the world, there's been a revival, breakout among God's people that swept thousands in. Now, concerned people would like to know what the key to revival is, don't you think? Well, this is the nearest to an answer that I've ever heard. What's the key to revival? When does revival come? So Edmund quotes Finney as saying, when two or more people get right with each other and with God, revival comes from that spot. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Now, if this is true, where does the blame for the lack of revival lie? What two persons should be any more right with one another than a husband and wife? I doubt if this is accurate, but it's interesting, isn't it? If this reasoning is correct, the hindrance to revival in the world today is the lack of a perfect relationship between the people that should be closer together than anybody on earth. So this is important. Well, that's all I've got to say. What do you have to say? Comment or a question? We've got some husbands in this room that have been a real challenge to me. I think of Charlie Holt and Bob Potter, especially. Yes.
How can you even talk at the same time?
Well, I like the old world concept of a meal, and that is that in the old world, Europe and England, every meal is a ritual and a ceremony. The food is just incidental. So I think we need to reorient our schedule so that the meal is something more than going to the gas station and fill her up and then get on the way. It's going to take more time, isn't it? Anybody else have a suggestion to him on this?
Men don't have any trouble talking with other men over lunch.
Good thought. Okay, anybody else? Any thought on this?
I've got a question inside me. A lot of times what women talk about is what we call gossip. And we're frequently mind. I've got not to pass things off about people. And I'm a physician, everybody's interested in who's sick. I can't go talking about my patients, my wife. So this automatically happens. It cuts out a large segment of the so-called conversation. I cut out from that gossip. Then I'd like to know, what I'd like some practical examples of what's left.
I don't have the answer, but I used to have a similar problem, Doctor. In the military, I was cleared for top secret. And I always claimed that I couldn't remember what I'd read in top secret documents and what I'd read in the newspaper. So if I talked, I might just inadvertently disclose something that I'd read in top secret. But she wouldn't buy that. We have a number of foreign staff. And one of our fellows out in the Philippines asked me a while back, he said, I'd like for you to pray for me along a particular line. And he said that is to enjoy small talk, to get next to these nationals, that you've got to just waste hours in small talk. So, I don't know, somebody here ought to have some answer if they... There must be some small talk someplace.
The definition of what we just referred to as gossip, we can set up a little book of the week. Is it kind? Is it the truth? Is it essential? And it's very simple to, in a book, not many other people's affairs, but about three questions. And if you can't say yes to all three, oh, brother, leave it alone.
Okay, that's an interesting thought. Yes.
We don't very often follow this, but I think the scripture gives the answer to how to influence people, including our own lives. It tells us to always accentuate the positive, Dale Carnegie said, don't criticize, condemn, or complain. And whatever you're talking about, but the Bible had said it a long time ago, whatsoever things are pure and loving and good report and so forth. If we keep our conversation in these terms, it's on a pretty high plane and pretty safe.
Isn't the real problem in this motivation? This part in here goes into this some, that women can get interested in the most unimportant things at the most inappropriate time. Well, this is just the beginning, but we've run out of our scheduled time. I hope we'll reflect on this week, and I know that I need a lot of improvement. And that's the reason that my wife should have talked to you instead of me, because she could give you a lot more information on what a godly husband is supposed to do than I could.